Professors FM.
Doug, as you know, we have joined the Professors FM podcast network. So it's extremely exciting. It's like, for the first time in my life, I'm going to have academic friends. This is big. And as part of this, we're going to talk about some of the other shows on the network. One of the things we talk a lot about in terms of sports analytics is the role of incentives, right? It's all about incentives. And so one of the other shows on the network is called Taxes for the Masses, brought to you by Lisa DeSimone from the University of Texas and Bridget Stomberg from Indiana University. And so what these two ladies do is they dive into all things taxes. I think it's a great compliment to what we do. In some ways, there's nothing bigger in public policy than taxes in terms of shaping the economy and society, because taxes change how people behave. So, you know, give it a listen. Great show.
Analytics with Mike Lewis, the podcast where we talk about everything you need to know about sports analytics. Here's your host, Mike Lewis, marketing professor at Emory University.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics podcast. My name is Mike Lewis. I am joined by Mr. Doug Battle. We are brought to you by the Emory Marketing Analytics Center. Doug, a lot of interesting stuff happening in the world of sports, but at least from my perspective, there's not one obvious story, a lot of interesting stuff happening. There was a championship over the weekend. The WNBA championship was determined. The Chicago Sky beat the Phoenix professional women's basketball.
Which apparently team. You don't even know the name of, nor do I.
I didn't know at some point.
Huge story. All I saw was that Candace Parker played. And I forgot that she was still playing basketball. I don't know. I think she became a mother at some point. That's an interesting part of the WNBA, is when they become mothers and they leave the league for a little bit. But I remember she married, was it Sheldon Williams from Duke? He was a stud.
And where are we going with this?
I'm saying, a little prediction here. Yeah. Their child that they had at some point is going to be a super basketball player, because that dude was like all ACC. She was dunking in college. I mean, like, that is perfect genetics for a future basketball player. So be on the lookout. Everyone's always talking about Bronny Jr. or whatever. I'm looking for Candace Parker's child to be making moves. And I don't know if it's boy or girl, but if it's a girl, it's going to be the best WNBA player ever.
The child already has three offers. Yeah.
Build it up. The most interesting story is Coach O. To me, most interesting to me. That's subjective.
Well, let's get there. I mean, just a couple of comments about the WNBA, and I think it's the Phoenix Mercury.
Yeah,
that up, so I may have forgot it and then gotten it wrong. The Mercury features Brittany Griner, who I think is always going to be an interesting WNBA player. She was the woman that got so much attention a few years ago. I think she may have dunked in a game as well. Really portrayed as a beast, at something like 6'6" or 6'7".
She was one of those where people were saying in college, oh, she could play in the NBA, which we don't have to get into that. But she was one of those. She was one of those. She's like so tall,
right?
Or listed at so tall. Let's say that much.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting to me about the WNBA is that is the one sport whose ratings have gone up post-pandemic. So I think they are up about 20% from 2019 even. So, you know, almost all of sports has suffered a little bit or remained flat. But the W, and I don't have an answer to this, so, you know, maybe this is the wrong topic for the professor to bring up. I don't have an explanation for it. But it is a little bit of an outlier in that, like I said, it's relatively robust growth. They perform pretty strong in their version. I think they call it the wobble, and have, you know, continued to set new standards coming out of it. Now, that being said, it is lightly watched. I think I saw something that they're talking about 300,000 viewers for that championship game. But it is, you know, the WNBA has now been around for 25 years, Doug.
Oh, that is crazy. I will say, I saw the highlights from that just on ESPN, and it looked like an NBA Finals game as far as when it ended, and Candace Parker's like running down the court, and like people were like, she was crying and stuff. Like, this really meant something to a lot of people. I don't know that the WNBA has meant something to a lot of people for very long. So it might be around for 25 years, but I definitely think it takes time to build that fan passion, but we've seen that a little bit. And as far as why it has grown, my biggest guess is just like, I think that there's kind of a, we've seen it in soccer, like an equality movement where I think women are becoming more supportive of women's sports. And that's my best guess. I don't know, though. Haven't researched the WNBA's growth by any means, but I know that they're like on the cover of NBA 2K now. So I think it's become more of a priority of the NBA to push that league and to promote women in basketball. I know Kobe Bryant was a huge advocate for that, and more players are speaking up on it. So I think the NBA plays a big part in it as well.
Well, I think that's all fair. The WNBA has received a lot of marketing support over the years. I mean, it's clearly before your time, but I remember when that league was just starting. I think you're 25, yeah, right? And when that league was just starting out, there was Lisa Leslie for, I think, the Los Angeles Sparks and Rebecca Lobo for the New York Liberty that were really trotted out and almost made household names, mm-hmm, to launch the league. So it's an interesting story. I mean, you bring up obviously what's sort of the good point about this of how long does it take to build a league? At least 25 years. It's interesting that they've started to get a little bit of traction. I don't have too much to say or too much speculation. It's more of one of these kind of interesting data points that we'll just collect some data points and eventually tell a story. Now, the WNBA finishes, and we immediately move on to one of your favorite, yeah, sports,
right,
properties, and that's the NBA season tips off tomorrow evening with, we tape on Monday, release on Tuesday, featuring the, I believe it's the Milwaukee Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets.
New Jersey Nets. I pulled for them back in the day, but they no longer exist. Yeah, Milwaukee and Brooklyn tomorrow at 7:30 Eastern time on TNT. Crazy to me. Like, this really snuck up on us. I haven't heard a ton of chatter about the NBA. I think because of the timing of it. I think last year the season started late, and so it was maybe more of a dominant storyline. But right now, starting the season at the height of football season, middle of October, baseball, which is increasingly a huge story. I'm hearing more and more about. We've kind of tracked that over the weeks, and the lack of attention being given to Major League Baseball. It's seeing more and more right now. So it's kind of a saturated sports market at the moment. Hockey starting up as well. So we're coming to that beautiful time of year when like everything's in season. Like, you like baseball? Best time of year for baseball. You like college football? You like the NFL? All that's going on. And then NBA's tipping off. To me, NBA is, it's all preseason to me until the playoffs. I think a lot of fans view it that way. But nevertheless, I mean, you can watch Giannis go against Kevin Durant and probably not Kyrie Irving because of COVID tomorrow. So,
well, Doug, let me read off the, I pulled the Vegas odds this morning, and you tell me what you know, how much this makes sense to you. You know, when you're saying not a lot of chatter about the NBA, maybe there's a reason for that, because the favorite going into the season is the Brooklyn Nets. Number two, you want to take a guess?
Milwaukee.
It's the Los Angeles Lakers.
Wow.
Followed by the Golden State Warriors, Milwaukee Bucks.
Milwaukee's
Suns,
that
Utah
far
Jazz,
back?
Los Angeles Clippers, Philadelphia 76ers. I mean, these were almost the odds going into last season.
Yeah, I think so. The Lakers will be, I think they're going to be like the villains for a lot of people because they're so stacked. They're kind of like the old Miami Heat. You got LeBron, Russell Westbrook. That's two guys that a lot of people just don't like. Anthony.
Well, what do you, let me pause you there. What do you think about that pairing? Do you think that's going to, you watch more basketball than I do. Do you think that nucleus is going to click, really come together cohesively?
That's what I'm curious to see, because you throw on Carmelo Anthony, he's one that kind of is a been perceived as a chemistry destroyer over the years. It's so much talent. I think it's an undeniable amount of talent where they're going to have crazy highlights and they're going to run it up on teams and be competitive just purely from sheer talent. But with the Lakers, we've seen this in the past where they stack teams with some older veteran players. I remember when it was Steve Nash, Kobe Bryant, Dwight Howard, etc. And a lot of people picked them to win the finals. And they were horrible. They were not good. In years back, they added Gary Payton and some of those guys to the Shaq Kobe team. So we've seen the Lakers do this over the years. It's just kind of what they do. The age, I think the biggest issue for them is talent. I mean, not talent. Definitely not an issue. The biggest issue is injuries, age and injuries. They've got an old core, and it's made up mostly of guys that have significant injury histories. And so, you know, if they can stay healthy, I think they can beat anybody, even though it won't be my favorite basketball. I prefer teams like the Bucks that move the ball well and are built from the ground up. The Lakers feel kind of thrown together, super team, whatever. But nevertheless, if they're healthy, I think they can play against anyone. I just don't expect them to be healthy for a whole season. I'm kind of bearish on the Lakers for that reason.
That's fair. A lot of 35 and up guys. And, you know, when athletic performance falls, it tends to fall off a cliff. Looking at this list of the favorites to the underdogs in the NBA, one of the things I can't help but notice is where the Clippers rank on this list. And, you know, these are preseason expectations and they may overperform. Where the Clippers are on this list, where the 76ers are on this list, the Clippers are sort of the number 7 betting pick. The 76ers are number 8. The Celtics are number 13. Mm. Have a bunch of teams missed their window here? Ooh,
Celtics, that's gotta hurt a little bit. Years back, they had finessed the Nets out of every draft pick for several years, and they ended up all being high draft picks, and their fans wanted to trade the picks for this superstar and that superstar. They ended up saving the picks, and they got Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. At a bargain for how good they are, being on rookie contracts at the time. And it felt like, you know, they're going to build a dynasty. Danny Ainge has got something going on. Now they're not perceived as a top 10 team in the league, and they're kind of at the peak of what those assets could bring them. I think Brad Stevens, as the essentially general manager, I think he has a different title, but he's got his work cut out for him to make that team into a championship team. 76ers, another one, lost on a buzzer beater in a game 7 to a Kawhi Leonard Raptors team that would go on to win the finals, and that's the closest they've come, period. So yeah, it feels like their window has passed, but they have such great pieces, obviously Joel Embiid, and I mentioned Tatum and Brown. What was the other team you mentioned?
The Clippers.
Yeah, I remember that offseason.
Yeah.
Where it was like Kawhi Leonard was the real holy grail of the NBA. Everybody wanted him, and it felt like whoever gets him, he's either going to be paired with LeBron or Paul George or one of the, you know, he's going to be paired with somebody, and any of those duos is going to be championship bound. Well, the Lakers lost out on him to the Clippers, and the Clippers, it feels like their window is, they haven't gotten it done. They haven't really gotten close. I think their best odds were in the bubble 2 years ago. And of course the Lakers won that year. They won the finals. So yeah, those are all teams that are in a tight spot. Obviously the Celtics fandom is so passionate. I think the Sixers fandom is pretty passionate as well. Those are two iconic basketball franchises where they always feel like they're one player away, and they still feel that way. So it's like, we'll see what happens, but it's hard to win a championship on it. Mid-season trade or things of that nature. Usually it's kind of done in the offseason for the championship team. So those teams do seem to have missed their window. I think the most interesting story that doesn't get talked about enough in basketball is if you go back to those Nets-Celtics trades years back when Danny Ainge seemingly fleeced the Nets for an aging Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, etc. I don't remember if Jason Terry was involved in that trade or not. But the Nets were the big losers, and yet they're competing for championships, or they're a true top team in the NBA. sooner than the Celtics became. It's like, is it better to just always go for the big stars and go all or nothing over and over and over again like the Nets have until something sticks, or to build through draft picks and the draft? I think that's a story that shows how the NBA has changed in these kind of super team eras.
Well, my takeaway from looking at all this is, you know, I assume there's a healthy amount of money flowing into, you know, betting on these kind of things, but I have no idea why anyone's putting any dollars on any of this stuff. You know, for the Brooklyn Nets to be the favorite, and like, I've been scouring the internet a little bit today, and as far as I can tell, there's no movement from Kyrie Irving whatsoever. Also,
it's not like he's a trade asset at this point. I don't know that what you could get in return for a guy that can't play his home games.
Well, he can't play some of the road games either, right? I mean, it's interesting that they are the betting favorite and a relatively heavy favorite. And number two is like the definition of the collection of aging stars put together for a final run or two. Maybe it'll play out. It almost seems like it's sort of wishful thinking, because boy, that would be a great series.
It would be.
And the Brooklyn Nets versus the, you know, Durant versus
LeBron
across, you know, the coastal series.
Yeah. East Coast,
it's something
West
the
Coast.
NBA desperately wants.
Yeah, I think that would be a great thing for the NBA. It's just the odds of it happening with the injury situations, and it doesn't seem like the NBA is budging on COVID either when it comes to Kyrie. So that one's just at a standstill. It's like, he's, knowing him, he's not going to get vaccinated. You know, he's not going to budge. He's not going to be told what to do and take an L on that.
I don't think he is. And I don't think a lot of people understand Kyrie. And I don't, Doug, you've been working with me for a long time now. I may share some similar traits as Kyrie.
Flat Earth.
issues with authority, perhaps. If I'm Kyrie and I'm looking at all this, first off, Kyrie's got enough money. He probably doesn't need to play again. But this is a very interesting time. You know, just beyond the world of sports, right? This is where all the vaccine mandates are starting to bite, right? I think they're talking about starting to fire cops in Chicago, in Seattle. While at the same time, we've got Dr. Anthony Fauci talking about how he misjudged the super spreader nature of 90,000 people in stadiums in the South. And so if Kyrie is looking at the data and sort of watching to see this play out, I could definitely imagine, even if he wants to play this year, to just saying, you know, I'll wait. Maybe I'll start playing midway through the season. But I don't see any reason why Kyrie would budge, given the big picture of all this and the fact that the Nets are the favorite to win the NBA. I don't know if that betting line has sort of priced in Kyrie's likely absence. I find it a little bit hard to believe that it's already priced into that. Otherwise, I suppose the Nets would be the prohibitive favorites. So I suspect the Kyrie story is not something that's going to be determined by week one. It's something that's going to play out for a couple of months here.
Yeah, I wouldn't honestly be shocked if Kyrie just retires at some point and later comes back out of retirement like next year or something, whenever all this settles down. But I would not be shocked. I think I've heard that, you know, rumored as a, I guess, negotiating tactic and all of this. But the Nets really probably feel like they should have traded him last year at some point. I remember that being discussed, and his fit with Durant and Harden, because there was a time when Kyrie was out last year and the Nets were thriving without him. It felt like, man, what if they moved him and added some depth for their bench or a different piece in play? Maybe the Nets would even be better without him if they were to make some kind of trade. But now they're the big loser to me is the Nets, because you have a salary cap. So much of it is allotted toward this player who won't play. Even before all this, there was always a reason for him not to play, protesting something or getting hurt or whatever. He hasn't played as much as he's expected to play. And that's like a third of their salary cap right there. So the Brooklyn Nets, nevertheless, I think they probably have like a top five odds without Kyrie this year. That's kind of the interesting thing to me.
I think that's probably true. Just looking at the teams that are up there, they might be in. They're probably still in the very top group. But are they the relatively big favorite? Okay, Doug, I'm going to ask you sort of more of a fan opinion question. So going into last year's playoffs, where we talked a lot about almost coming of age narratives, kind of the young gunslingers moving up, and you had Devin Booker, Luka Doncic, you had Trae Young. So based on all of that, and what, if anything, those clubs did, who's the next star? Who is the heir apparent going into this?
I wanted to see Devin Booker take the reins in the finals and be that guy, and it really seemed like he faded back in that series. Trae Young absolutely took the NBA by storm in the playoffs last year. And he's such a flashy player. As good as he is and as good as that young Hawks team is, I think they're going to be very much in the mix this year. I kind of think that he's the guy, because not so much because he's a better player than Luka Doncic, because I don't believe that to be the case, but because of how he's positioned. He's on a team that's kind of viewed as the underdogs, but if you look at him, it's hard not to pick them against a lot of teams, and they're very competitive, and they're in an Atlanta market that is really starting to embrace the Hawks, this kind of rebranded version of the Hawks. And so I think he's best positioned for that of those players. Obviously, Jason Tatum's another guy in Boston who's really come into his own in recent years. It's just Boston's kind of stuck in that spot where they feel stuck. Atlanta feels like they're on the way up. Dallas with Luka just carries that team. I went to a game last year, and he's phenomenal to watch. He's one of the most interesting basketball players I've ever seen, because he's kind of slow. Like he's really not the better athlete than a lot of guys, but he's such a crafty basketball player, and he's such a wizard out there that he can toy around with guys that are way more athletic than him every single night. When I watched him, it was Kawhi Leonard and Paul George trying to defend him, and neither one knew what to do with him, and he looked like the slowest guy on the court. So he's not as flashy, but he puts up crazy numbers, and he's clutch, and he carries his team. But that team, like, they're a fringe playoff team every year, and until they add another piece, he's got to be paired with somebody. I think they thought Porzingis would be the big star to pair him with, and post ACL, he just has not been the superstar that he looked to be prior to that injury. And so Luka's in a position where, I think if you put Luka on Atlanta, I'd be saying Luka easy. And Luka's on the cover of 2K this year, by the way. So, he's that guy. But nevertheless, as far as who I think has the biggest opportunity to emerge right now, Trae Young and those Hawks, they're going to be in the mix in the playoffs, I think. And I think that's what it's all about in the NBA.
I the memory had faded until we started talking about it, and it's going back to that Knicks series and some of the chants. The Trey, what was it? Trey is balding. Or something. Trey is balding. And he played that perfectly, right? He's got that. There's something fun about him, right? There's something fun about him on the on the court, in terms of even how he interacts with the fans, which I think is a major plus. Now, should he shave his head? I don't know that he's got the look for shaving his head, but
he
might want to do something about that.
Well, it might. Part of me was thinking the same thing. I've always felt like, God, he'd be so much cooler if his hair was, if he had cornrows or something, like if he just did something different. But on the flip side of that, you think about Anthony Davis, the brow, as he is called. He was kind of, in college, people thought he was this ugly guy, because he had a unibrow, and it was a weird thing. But he embraced it and kind of built his brand around it. And you can tell he gets eyebrow jobs now, because they're so, like, the lines on them are so distinct and stuff. But he's really built a brand around that, just like the beard for James Harden. And so it's like, I don't know, maybe the uniqueness of Trae Young's look, and the fact that it gives opponents something to really hate on, and then gives him some fuel to respond to. Maybe it's a good thing for him, for Trae Young and his brand. But I think he's best positioned this year. I think Devin Booker is the other one, just because the Phoenix Suns are a very good basketball team and competitive team. And like I said, last year, I really wanted to see him take over. I know a lot of people were starting to compare him to Kobe Bryant and stuff earlier in the playoffs. Obviously not that caliber of player relative to this point in Kobe's career. But nevertheless, he's one where he'll be positioned to take over, to be the guy for the Phoenix Suns. Whereas last year, it felt like Ayton and Chris Paul took a lot of that in the biggest moments.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit silly, but in all seriousness, the Trae Young situation and those chants out of New York and maybe a crazy hairline, I don't think we should actually underestimate how relevant that might be to stardom and towards building a brand. Because you could imagine Trae Young, and it's a little bit hard for me to say this because there's something very likable about him, but you could almost imagine him becoming sort of an NBA villain that every opposing fan base sort of loves to hate because he's sticking the dagger in and they've got such a go-to cheer that it may well be one of these kind of strange circumstances where the stars align and he becomes the poster child for the NBA, whether or not he's out playing some of these other, you know, 25, 26 year olds.
But yeah, getting back, you know, comparing that to Devin Booker. Devin Booker's a guy that scored, I believe he scored 70 points in a game like 2 years ago as a very young player in the league. Plays on last year the second best team in the NBA at the end of the season. But for whatever reason, he's never been like, from a marketing standpoint, he's never been like the face of anything. Like he's never felt like distinct in that way, where Trae Young has a very distinct thing, as does the Brow, who I mentioned, or James Harden, or all these guys, you know, Kevin Durant, Durantula.
I think playing in the West Coast or in the Western, in the, you know, the West time zones tends to be a huge disadvantage unless you're in places like LA or San Francisco, right? It's like they almost tend to forget about, well,
especially
some of
Phoenix,
these guys, whether
they're, know, who has great fans, by the way, but it's just not a nationally.
Yeah. But Phoenix, Denver, Salt Lake City,
Jokic.
Right?
he's one of those guys that it's like maybe he would be the face of the NBA if his name were something else and he played for Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, it's almost like there's a little bit of a matching between the player and the market and how much, and look, this is definitely true. I mean, you think about how sports media works and who's going to get the attention. I mean, you know, it's built around, like, if LeBron goes to Salt Lake City, it doesn't matter. He's still the focal point for the league. But in general, you know, playing in New York, playing in Chicago, playing in LA, it's going to make a bit of a difference.
And getting back to those young stars, it's like, I think Jason Tatum's the best position as far as being in Boston, playing for an iconic franchise. But given the position of the Celtics relative to the Hawks, you know, Atlanta, it's like, it's thought of as the small market in the NBA terms, because it's not Chicago, it's not Los Angeles, it's not New York. But Atlanta's not exactly a small market, if we're being technical. And it's also a growing fan base. It's very much on the rise. And so I think Trae Young being the face of that, to me, just like I said, gives him the leg up on being that next guy.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of these markets are actually very similar in size. Right. Atlanta is pretty close to actually the Boston market, very different history. And it's similar in size to Phoenix and Dallas. They're these sort of 5, 6, 6.5 million people metro areas that I think were historically B-level markets, right? That this is where the growth has been and the media attention hasn't shifted to appreciate how big these cities are. That Atlanta and Dallas are the equivalent to Philadelphia and Boston, but that's not where the tradition.
But hey,
lies.
Let's go back to the next generation of players. We've been talking about this kind of these guys that are coming in their prime. I think that next gen with Anthony Edwards and LiAngelo Ball, those are guys who maybe aren't in the best markets, but I also think they're very well positioned to make big jumps this year, become all-stars. It's rumored that Anthony Edwards says that he grew 2 inches in the offseason. He's now 6'6", which is pretty crazy, but it shows how young these guys are. I mean, it's a, 19, 20-year-old kid out there. Those two, I mean, they make highlight reel plays every time you watch them. And I also think both of them have a shot at being that next guy. I just think that playing in Minnesota and playing in Charlotte doesn't best position you for taking over the NBA.
You know, that's actually very funny. I mean, you think about just, you know, the sports analytics person in me immediately went to the question of, like, when you start to have 18 and 19-year-olds in the league, you know, it's always been like this joke about open growth plates, but that's a legitimate issue, because if he did, in fact, grow 2 inches, that's a pretty significant change in the physical nature of the player from, what do you say, 6'4 to 6'6?
I personally think that Anthony Edwards is the best prospect of any of these young guys in the NBA as far as like having the potential to be this mega star. He's got a phenomenal personality. He's like the Marshawn Lynch of NBA basketball, and then it's just highlight reel plays every night. The question with him, and going back, this was the question in the draft, was like, does this guy have a hard work ethic, or is he just goofing around all the time? It's like he's almost got a Shaq reputation, or Dwight Howard even, of being this fun guy, and yet he performs well at a high level, and I think he is competitive, so he's one I'm keeping an eye on. Obviously, I'm a Georgia guy, but it's not really as much because of that, as, you know, he's just truly a 6'6" guy that got hops like Vince Carter and can shoot like Kevin Durant, you know, on any given night. There aren't many prospects like that when you talk about these, even when we're talking about Devin Booker and Trae Young and these guys. I don't know if any of them have the raw ability or raw potential that a guy like Anthony Edwards has. So we'll see.
Okay, any last thoughts about the NBA? Are you ready to move on? Some interesting... Yeah. To me, maybe not incredibly important stories, but some interesting stories from the world of college football. And
my last thought here is on the Milwaukee Bucks. I can almost like assure you that if you took the same roster and coaching staff and championship pedigree now and put them in Los Angeles, they would be the odds-on favorites to win the NBA Finals again. People would be, you know, people would be saying they're going to repeat. You got Giannis, who's a two-time MVP, Finals MVP as well. And a returning cast of a team that dominated the NBA Finals last year, dominated the entire NBA playoffs, and has honestly been dominant for 5-ish years. They just haven't put it all together until last year. I feel like they're forgotten because they're Milwaukee. You know, their jerseys are kind of bland. It's not a big market. They have one superstar and that's it. They're built from the ground up. It's not all these different brands colliding. It's just, for whatever reason, there's this bias against the small market team doing anything of significance, especially two times in a row.
But that's probably a good word for it, right? And there's a little bit of discounting that happens with their championship last year, that, you know, that the Nets were not at full strength and the Lakers were not at full strength.
But do we expect either of those teams to be at full strength? Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, it's like, I think it's the sort of the stories that people tell themselves, right? So, you know, Milwaukee had struggled to get over the hump, and then they got over the hump, but you could almost tell this tale that, well, but there were injuries.
It took a game 7 overtime with Durant's toe being on the line hardly for them to even make it to the finals.
Yeah. Okay, Doug, so we continue to enjoy the college football season, strange season. I made a joke to someone. It's like, maybe the AP won't have a number 2 team this year, this week, after Iowa lost pretty badly to Purdue at home. That, you know, is it going to be, I suppose it's going to be Georgia 1. Maybe it already is Georgia 1 and Cincinnati 2.
Cincy 2, baby.
But what a crazy... What a crazy top of the thing. I keep coming back to the fact that but Georgia has a walk-on quarterback and does seem to absolutely be the class of college football. Now, that being said, Alabama can play one bad game and they can be right back up.
They're number 4.
Top, you know, instantaneously. Number 4.
They lost to an unranked opponent last week and they're number 4 in the country. But, if you look at it, I would say if I were a Michigan fan, I'd be kind of mad. If I were a Michigan State fan, Oklahoma State, any of these teams that are undefeated. But other than that, I mean, Oklahoma, number 3, 7-0, they've hardly I mean, they could be 0-7 if or I guess they could be 1-6 very easily. And Bama, Ohio State hasn't looked good to me. I see the interesting story to me that no one's talking about is like Michigan and Michigan State both being undefeated and having the opportunity to be that Big Ten team that makes it in, overthrow Ohio State finally. I don't know why it's not being talked about. Michigan's such a sleeping giant in football, and they're undefeated halfway through the season.
Right. I'm like pulling up the schedule. I want to see who Michigan is actually played this year.
Anybody too good if they're ranked 6.
Okay, so looks like Northern Illinois, Wisconsin, who has faded quite a bit, Northwestern, Nebraska, Rutgers. So it's been a very light schedule for Michigan so far.
Right.
But yeah, you know, when you have the pedigree, when you're a blue blood like Michigan and you're undefeated at this point in the season, you almost automatically expect some.
Well, especially after so many years of not being good. I mean, I remember Georgia's second year under Kirby Smart, and granted, we had played, I don't know, Notre Dame, who wasn't even that good, but they're just a big brand football team, and people started to respect Georgia around this time of year, where it was like, well, we're undefeated, we just got to win 6 more, and we'll be in the playoff. Michigan's in that position right now, and I don't feel like anyone's talking about it. So, 5-6 is Ohio State, Michigan. And Ohio State's one loss, Michigan's not.
Right, but, you know, it's one of those things where the road to the Big Ten championship game goes through, maybe the game is at Ohio State this year, I'm not mm-hmm. sure, that Michigan has, you know, as we talked about some of the scenarios with Georgia and Alabama, Michigan has to beat Ohio State and then win go on to the Big Ten championship game to have a shot at this. And Ohio State has exactly the same path despite having that loss.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this. Cincinnati. If Cincinnati had lost to unranked Texas A&M in the fashion that Alabama did, is Cincinnati number 4 in the country right now?
No, they are. And I don't think they have any prospects to get into the top 4 mm-hmm. for the play. They're
eliminated.
Fifth. They then cap out at 5, I think.
It's interesting with Alabama to me because part of me is like, oh, that's bias. The other part of me is like, as a Georgia fan, the team that I'm most concerned about is Alabama. That's the team we don't want in. It was the same case in 2017. We were like, this isn't fair. They shouldn't be in. You know, they haven't earned it. But all knowing, they probably have the best chance of beating us of anyone. And they did in 2017. And so it's like, you know, I think there is an eye test aspect, and there is there's also a history aspect. People know not to count Bama out at this point because they've seen it before.
Right. And I got to tell you, I look forward to one of my favorite parts of the football season. Like I enjoy the games, but you know, I also enjoy the stuff on the periphery. And I pulled you back from it a couple of weeks ago, but this is setting up to be one of these great end of the seasons in the SEC where there is endless debates about two SEC teams in the college football playoff, how whoever it is, Ohio State or Oklahoma, doesn't deserve to be there, or maybe Cincinnati doesn't deserve
Cincinnati
to be here.
It.
But what people don't get, and you know, people might disagree with me, but I've lived in Big Ten territory and I've lived in SEC country. The passion here is just at a different level. And the scenarios is that people down here will draw will be so much fun to watch. And it's a beautiful, it's almost like that Alabama loss makes it just a beautiful situation. Now, if they were both coming in, Georgia and Alabama coming in undefeated, going into that SEC championship game, then it's almost even better because then the fans down here could not believe the idea that they wouldn't both be going to the
college. I personally think that if Alabama wins, as long, you know, I think they both make it this year. So we'll see what happens. I almost expect that. Going back to what I was saying about, you know, if Cincinnati had the same resume as Alabama, would they be in the top 4? Think about Kentucky. This is a team that was undefeated until this week. Their one loss is to the number 1 team in the country. Not an unranked opponent, the number 1 team in the country. And they dropped to 15.
In Athens
with College Game Day. I mean, that's pretty much impossible for anyone to win in that setting this year. Dropped to number 15. They're ranked behind Coastal Carolina. Same record as Alabama. Quality loss. You know, a better opponent that they lost to, and just as tough of an environment. And they're back to number 15. They're like pretty much eliminated.
You might say this is sort of a Bayesian statistics approach to these things, where people don't forget the past, right? People look at the jerseys and then make the judgment about the team. And we're seeing this all over, right? The case of Alabama being in the top four, Michigan being ranked behind Ohio State.
Yeah, that's two perfect examples.
Kentucky dropping precipitously when they suffer, wearing the shiniest helmets I've seen on the field this season.
I think they're a little gimmicky. They're not my favorite. I'll also add to that same thing, and this is kind of the Bama effect. Mississippi, or Ole Miss rather, Ole Miss gets annihilated by Alabama, who later loses Texas A&M. Ole Miss drops to 12. Like I said, Kentucky loses in similar fashion to the number one team in the country. They're down to 15. So the Alabama loss was a more quality loss, I think, for Ole Miss in the eyes of the pollsters here than the Kentucky loss to the number one team in the country.
Other fun story from SEC country was Ed Orgeron beats Florida and gets fired.
Florida gets fired. Gotta love it. SEC football. I remember Mark Richt getting fired the day after beating Georgia Tech and leading his team to 40 wins in four seasons. That's SEC football. I've got to say, with Coach O, I know that a lot's kind of coming up about off the field stuff. I said it last year. I don't think I said it on air, but I did say it to the people I was talking to about LSU. There was a lot coming up about Darius Geis and an alleged sexual assault case that the coaches and administrators at LSU allegedly worked to cover up. There was a pretty tough quote from Ed O that would cost you your career and just about any other job. And what I was saying at the time was, nothing happens until they start losing football games, and then all of this gets brought to light. Then the boosters and the AD and everybody start saying, let's take a look into this. Let's see what, you know, ethically, how, if we could do a better job, if these coaches aren't getting it done. That's the fireable offense. That's how they get out of paying the buyout. And so for Coach O to have gotten away with some of this stuff in the past, and then now that his team is clearly not on the right track, although they did beat Florida, and I took great pleasure in that as a Georgia guy. But, it's classic college football.
Well, I mean, in some ways, if one guy should be coaching in the SEC, it's Coach O, right? I mean, I guess you'd say, like, Lane Kiffin belongs in the SEC, too. It's like these guys seem like they're almost throwbacks to, you know, the Spurrier era.
I don't really want to see much,
you know, personalities
much
in the field.
Change in SEC. You look right now, this is the golden age. I mean, it is like an ensemble cast of greatness with Mike Leach, Coach O, Lane Kiffin.
Mike Leach.
You know, the Auburn guy, I haven't seen, he hasn't been weird enough for me, although there were some weird stories in the offseason. Obviously, he was a guy that got COVID and wasn't vaccinated at the time, and so that was a whole story. But he hasn't been as weird as I hoped. You know, Gus Malzahn was one of those guys in that conversation last year. But Nick Saban being kind of the godfather of the league, and Kirby Smart being the dominant but perceived as weird by opponents because of his bowl cut and country accent. It's just such a great cast of coaches in the SEC. It's perfect. They're a perfect representation of SEC football right now.
And that is perfect, right? Because there's something about the SEC where
Kirby I left Smart, out Dan Mullen.
Obviously, Dan Mullen. But Kirby Smart, obviously a smart guy. Obviously has turned Georgia into a rock-solid program where they can be the number one team in the country with a walk-on quarterback. But walks out to the field with a terrible haircut and a visor that just – and look, maybe it's strategy. People are going to underestimate him with that look. But Ed O's voice, Dan Mullen,
everything
posing
about him
with the Yeah, the posing with the shark. I don't even know if that was Dan Mullen.
McElwain, but Dan Mullen's claim to fame was wearing a Darth Vader helmet in a press conference last year. That was a real thing.
Okay. And Mike Leach, right? I mean, you could do a top 10 list of Mike Leach.
You do a top 1,000 list of Mike Leach moments.
Yeah.
So I'm, Florida fans are starting to want to fire their coach, and Coach O is going to be out at LSU after this year. I'm kind of sad. I like these characters. Coach O dominated Georgia, by the way. I went to two games. And we lost probably by a combined 100 points in those games. And I respected LSU and what they are. They just are what they are. Their fans are kind of trashy, and it's great. I don't say that in a negative way. Okay. I think it's great. I love their culture. I love going to Death Valley and seeing all their traditions and getting called things by their fans. It's just part of it, and people take it too seriously.
Well, and let's sort of put some brackets around there. That is a Georgia fan talking about LSU fans, and there's nothing better than that, right? I mean, every fan base has issues with every other fan base, and that's what makes this all beautiful.
Those weren't issues, though. That's what people got to understand. I truly admire it. I truly, if they were all well-behaved, buttoned up, if that's how it was in the SEC, it just wouldn't be the same product. Having that true hatred and that true nastiness, and having the Tennessee fans throw stuff on the field, like, I'm here for it. I'm here as long as no one's getting hurt and no one's actually, you know, affected by it, and it's all just gestures. I'm all for it.
Well, and you know, I think it's something that people get upset about, but the reality is that it's everywhere, and 99% of the time, or 90%, maybe it's 90% of the time, it's good natured. Like in Illinois, you know, they would refer to Iowa as Iowa stood for idiots out walking around, and they would translate Illinois to something about Illinoising or something. Yeah. You know, I mean, who cares? It's Iowa fans. But that's kind of the point, right? That it's every one of these rivalries. It's kind of amazing, given how much passion there is, that there isn't more trouble in parking lots before and after games, which I think says something about how positive so much of
it's
this
playful.
Is. Even if
I think it's kind of fake. Like we all kind of agree to pretend to hate each other for a day. But it was really fun being on Spike Squad at Georgia, being one of the people painted up with the shoulder pads and doing, like, for example, a neutral site game against Florida and Georgia getting destroyed and walking out of that stadium, being the last Georgia fan there, surrounded by Florida fans, just dogging you, heckling you. And it's just part of it. It's like, if you can't take that, like, you should probably pick something else to be a fan of. But college,
that must have been a beautiful thing, walking out there in full face paint after a drubbing.
After a drubbing and getting shown on TV and getting memed and getting... We used to look up tweets of ourselves. People would say really mean stuff about us on the internet, and we got a kick out of it. We thought it was hilarious. So, you know, to me, it's like with the SEC football, that's part of it. It's all in good fun to me in SEC football for the most part. Every now and then there's something that crosses the line, and that's a different story. But as long, like I said, as long as it's gestures and not actual harm being done, like, it's part of it. That's SEC football. They can try to clean it up all they want, but there's no way to control Neyland Stadium with 100,000 people angry at the refs and the opposing coach who pretty much burned their program to the ground years back when he was their head coach.
Well, that brings to mind, we're running a little short of time here, and I do want to say something about baseball. Mm-hmm. My favorite moment of the NFL was Aaron Rodgers scoring a touchdown. And it just, you know, popped in my head as we're talking about the fandom in the SEC. Bears-Packers, that's a great rivalry going back.
One of the best.
Forever. That, you know, screaming at the crowd in his post-game press conference was great, that there was a woman giving him the double bird, and he just started yelling, "I own you," or something along those lines.
Yeah, I think he said, like, I still own the Bears.
I come from Chicago people. Bears fans hate Aaron Rodgers, but it is that special kind of hate that how could you not laugh at him telling them that he still owns them.
I love it. I love that about sports. And I don't think non-sports people people that didn't grow up in sports culture understand it quite as much. But I, when I was a player, when I played basketball and we would play, and I remember one school in particular, and their environment was crazy. We would play them before their homecoming or before one of their dances every year. And the, it was this whole scene. There was actual pageantry for high school basketball, or middle school basketball, whatever age it was. And I loved getting yelled at and getting booed and all that. It was fun, man. It's just part of, like, it makes it meaningful. And I think that's how everyone feels. I think that's why I get a little more excited for the big rivalry games with the team that I really hate, the team I really don't want to lose to, because I know that's coming and I know that's part of it. But you see the players, and even when I'm in games in Sanford Stadium, the opposing players, when they run out and crowd boos every time, and they, you know, they're gesturing toward the crowd to keep it coming, and there's players interacting with the crowd in those ways. It's all part of it. It's part of the experience. It's for the players and for the fans, and I'm all for it, like I said. Anyway, beautiful stories in SEC football this week. Coach O, obviously, maybe not a beautiful story. Who knows what gets uncovered with him now that everything's getting dug up on every coach. I would imagine there's probably some dirt somewhere that may justify his firing a little bit more. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Don't want to say anything that doesn't age well.
Okay. You know, I feel like we've stumbled onto the title for the episode, and I think it's something like The Beauty of the Ugly Fan. You know, going from Trey Young to the Chicago Bears end zone to all things SEC. Now, last topic I want to hit on is baseball. We are in the middle of the league championship series, and it's the Red Sox versus the Astros. I think that series is 1-1, and we've got the Braves up on the Dodgers 2-0. How much is Major League Baseball hoping for, or how much is Major League Baseball hoping against a Dodgers-Astros rematch from 2017?
I think it's great personally. I'm a little bit more prone to tune into that one because of the history, because of the cheat. There's a very clear good guy and bad guy. There's revenge. There's everything you want in the storylines, but there's also, it just kind of brings to light again a negative story for baseball, which they've been plagued with for my entire life, going back to steroids with Mark McGwire and just about every big hitter when I was a kid. And so maybe the MLB wants to move away from that, but like I said, I'm more prone to tune in and pull for the Dodgers, for Kershaw to get that championship he should have had previously, to stick it to the Astros. So we'll see. I know you and I both know a lot of Braves fans that are hoping that doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, the Braves look good. The Braves are, to me, the Braves are one of these fairly classy fan. I think most baseball fan bases are pretty classy at this point. They're almost the
It's not SEC football.
It's not SEC football. They tend to be calm, sort of wholesome. I mean, it's a great story for this city. I mean, the city is a little bit on an upswing, right, with the Hawks playoff run.
Everything but the Falcons, pretty much.
Yeah, and look, I tend to think, I don't know if you really put Georgia football with Atlanta, but if you live in this area, I would not be surprised. I mean, I'm like sort of doing a quick, you know, thinking process going through some cities. I bet you that Georgia football is the closest big-time football program in terms of being associated with a major metropolitan area, because Georgia does dominate this area. If you drive around in the city, you see a lot of, you know, red, black, and white G's on the back of trucks and cars. It's it is almost, you know, Athens is, what's Athens, about
an 40, hour?
Yeah. 40 minutes out, an hour out?
Yeah.
An hour out before you hit Atlanta traffic. But it's really part of the Atlanta sports scene.
Yeah, I think University of Georgia might have the biggest fan base of all the Atlanta sports teams, with maybe the Braves competing there. I don't know. The Braves have a lot of fans, but the passion is so strong in Atlanta for the Georgia.
It really
Bulldogs.
Depends on how you count. I think I suspect that, you know, because I've had some discussions with people over the years, and that if you count in certain ways, the Falcons have the largest fan base. But I think you're right. If you're talking about sort of really intense, passionate fans, I bet you there are more Georgia Bulldog fans in the city than there are really intense Atlanta Falcon fans. Now, that being said, it almost ends up being a little bit of a problem in terms of Atlanta sports dynamics, in that it's
the major leagues feel like minor leagues to a lot of people.
Well, and it also, I think, feels a little bit almost, you know, like a club that you can't really join, right? Because if you didn't go to UGA and you just moved to this city,
pull for the Georgia.
It's kind of hard to become a UGA fan.
Yeah, for sure. I've had that experience moving to different places, and even when it's not a college team, it's difficult to feel the passion for a team that you've had no life experiences with growing up, and just out of the blue become a fan of that team. So we'll see, but I do think with Braves fans and Atlanta sports fans as a whole, they've seen so many disappointments in these kinds of games. Obviously, the Super Bowl with the Falcons blowing the 28-3 lead against the Patriots being probably the most recent huge letdown in Atlanta sports. And so having a 2-0 lead on the defending champ Dodgers, I think, has a lot of Atlanta sports fans. And we've talked about the Atlanta sports curse in the past, but Georgia being number one, Atlanta being in that position, the Braves, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of sitting there saying, okay, what's going to go wrong? When's it going to happen?
Yeah.
When's it going to... They're the most scared fan base or group of fans in all of sports.
I haven't lived here that long, and just as you started to say that out loud, I can almost imagine people saying, shh, stop it.
Yeah.
Don't jinx this.
No, they do all the time. Even Georgia fans are like, don't say something good about Georgia on the internet. You're going to jinx it. That's how they think you're costing the team a championship if you say that we're the best team by a mile or something like that, you know, when people are just tweeting out their thoughts. And so it's a real cautious fan base who's going to be shocked if they ever, you know, actually get what they've been rooting for this whole time. So an interesting thing to keep an eye on. I'm really intrigued by that Dodgers Braves series.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun one. And, you know, baseball's got, they've got a little bit of an opportunity here, right? Because you look at the teams that are playing. I mean, there's potentially some nice narratives to work with. Now, can Major League Baseball get that story out, get enough media attention? You got some big markets in LA, Boston, even though Boston is about the same size as Atlanta, it seems like a bigger market.
Just because of the history. It's such a sports town.
Because of the history.
Yep.
Houston's a relatively big city as well, so you got big markets. You got potentially this revenge matchup. Always nice to get some, you know, championships or playoff contention in the Southeast, the growing area. So it sets up pretty well for Major League Baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. So just like that, Major League Baseball is looking to become the storyline in sports for the World Series.
For a week.
If things play out in the league's favor, we'll see what happens.
But as usual, right? I mean, the challenge for Major League Baseball is that I don't think it used to be this way, that when they take center stage, it's also the time when LeBron starts to play basketball. And it's also the middle of the season when maybe
college football playoff rankings start coming out.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and teams start jockeying for the NFL.
Playoff. So yeah. NFL playoff picture starts to take shape and get real competitive. That's just horrible timing. That's horrible timing for a league. No other league has to deal with that much traffic in their championship season, in their championship time of year.
Yeah. But for the rest of us, it's probably about the best time of year for sports. Because, look, I especially, and I don't know, what are we, about 2 weeks away or a week away from the college football playoff rankings?
No, when those release.
Yeah. I mean, got to be, if it's not, it's got to be relatively soon, probably about, you know, game seven or so. So, again, enormous fun on the way. Okay, Doug, we are at about 59 minutes, so any last comments? Anything you're looking forward to this week?
Well, I'll look back real quick. Last comment, I know we concluded last week's episode with you asking me my thoughts on Georgia-Kentucky, and I essentially said teams like Kentucky just don't have the horses to compete, no matter how well-coached they are, no matter how good of football teams they are, how much chemistry they have or whatnot. We saw that play out exactly. With Georgia, to me, the big story in college football that isn't getting enough credit is the Cincinnati team that took Georgia down to the wire, led Georgia for much of the game last year in their bowl game, having the opportunity to make the playoff, potentially get a rematch with Georgia, potentially get to take on a blue blood like Oklahoma or Alabama or Ohio State or even Michigan. And so I'm really curious to keep an eye on Cincinnati. We looked at their schedule last week, and it's not particularly hard. I'm looking at it now. Navy, Tulane, Tulsa, South Florida, SMU, and East Carolina. Win those games, win a conference championship, you're in the playoff. That's how it looks at the moment. College football playoff rankings haven't come out, but they're number two in the AP poll. So Cincinnati is a team that I'm very intrigued by as a college football fan, obviously as a Georgia fan. Bye week and then Florida coming up in a couple weeks should be an opportunity to put that program in a coffin for the time being. And honestly, the biggest story for me now is like, who's next? What coaches are we going to dig up dirt on next? We've in recent weeks had Urban Meyer, Roger Goodell, more recently Coach O, Ed Orgeron, after 2 years removed from a 15-0 season, is being fired. Who's next? It seems like these coaches are under a microscope now in this day and age at this point in time. I know Raiders quarterback Derek Carr recently came out and said he thinks all their emails should be reviewed. Which,
did he say that?
Yeah, Derek Carr came out. Yeah, and so yeah, everyone's on the hot seat, and regardless of their record at this point in time, I won't be surprised to see half the NFL coaches get fired. Not predicting that, but like I said, nothing would surprise me.
Well, I can't resist the little tongue-in-cheek jab that, say what you want about these coaches, it appears that Urban Meyer did find a way to motivate the Jaguars. this is football. This is a different kind of culture. In some ways, you know, we can celebrate when it's beautiful on the field, and we can celebrate when it's a glorious mess in the news. So let's sort of wrap up from there. As always, guys, there's more content on www.fandomanalytics.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.